sahanavavatu, sahanavapunaktu, sahavirayankaravavahai, tejasvinavatitamastu mavidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
Do you want to test that back again?
That's all.
You're welcome. So we're on verse 32. Okay. Gaveshanat prapya tadam tadam tata. Gaveshanat prapya ridantarantata patet patetahanta paribhugnishirsha patetahanta paribhugnishirsha atahamanyat spurati prakrishtam atahamanyat spurati prakrishtam nahang kritistat parameva purnam nahang kritistat parameva purnam. From the Gaveshana, the Gaveshana, Gaveshana means the inquiry or the searching, you know, the searching for oneself in the way that Ramana has been unfolding in these past few verses. So from this Gaveshana, searching for what he calls the Swamula, the mulam of the I, the root, the very root or the place from which the ahankara, the I thought, rises. So instead of looking outward to the what the ahankara, the I thought, is landing on, looking at from where the that from which the ahankara is rising, and because the I thought lands on the body or it lands on the thought like I am happy or I am sad or I am thinking or I am seeing or I am disbodied or I am a mother or sister or friend or whatever, it's always landing on something which is objectified. But if I am searching, and this is from the previous verses, if I'm looking for the place, the mula, the very root from which the ahankara rises, so to speak, its basis, then from that search, from that seeking, what happens is prapya, one gains. Hridya antaram, he says, that which is inside of the heart, inside of the buddhi. The hrit is the buddhi. So if the buddhi, if we look at the buddhi as the conscious mind, right, there's a couple of things happening in when you have a thought. There's the thought modification, which is the nama rupa, the names and forms of the thought, or the mood or the emotion of the thought, the changing content of the thought. So every thought that you have has this. It has a changing content which is known. Even moods are changing contents. Relationships are changing contents, like I could be the mother to my child, but the sister to my sibling, and the teacher to my student, etc. So those are all changing content. They're changing relational content. You know, it can be perceptual content. I see this and then I see that, then I hear this, I hear that. So the mind itself as changing content of all sorts. So that's one thing that's constant in the mind. And any whatever that thought may be, the other thing about it is that it is known. The changing content is always known. Whether it be a mood or a perception, doesn't make any difference. The known factor requires consciousness. For something to be known, consciousness is required. Right? So now, there's another type of a thought. There's all of these content thoughts that the buddhi can take on through sense perception or just through the manas moods or memories or whatever. There's also a thought called the ahankara, the I thought. That's also a thought. It's just that the I thought is a little different in character, in a sense. then is an object thought, right? A thought that I don't identify with. The ahankara, the I notion, is the thought that comes in and says, I am. And that thought, that's nothing more than a thought, because you're not always walking around with a thought, I am, I am, I am, I am. So it itself is a vritti, a thought modification. But that thought modification is always connected to the consciousness aspect of the thought. The painting or the rug or the mood is not connected so much to the consciousness aspect of the thought. So the ahankara is the one that says, I am, right? Or I am the knower. It's always connected to the ultimate, ultimately to the subject, me. And then relating me, it relates me, that I thought relates me to whatever is being experienced in the thought, the content of the thought. So if the content of the thought happens to be an emotion, then the ahankara will come along and say, I am, I, this conscious being, am sat. If it happens to be a perception that I use my sense organs for, it will come along and say, I am the knower of the painting, for instance, where the mind is taking on a thought modification because of my sense organs. It's taking on a thought modification of the painting. And I'm not going to say, I am the painting. I'm going to say, I am the one who knows the painting, because the painting is something that's external to this body, and so that I won't identify with it. If it's not external to the body, I'll have the experience and identify myself as the experience. That's why I'll say, even though this physical body, if this physical body, even though it's known to me really by the five sense organs, you know, sense of touch pervades the whole body, I see it, I hear it, I taste it, all, that's how I know this body. But the sense of touch, because it goes through the whole body, the whole subtle body, because of that, my subtle body seems to abide in this physical body or be totally united with this physical body, so that I don't only say, I know this body. I can say, oh yes, I'm aware of my body, I know my body. But I don't have any viveka to say, I am not the body. I will say, I am this body, which is known to me. But I won't say, I am the painting, which is known to me, or I'm the space that is known to me. So this ahankara, the I notion, will always identify with the conscious aspect of the thought, you know, and then hook the conscious aspect of the thought onto what it is perceiving. See what I mean? So if I say, I am, that's I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being, that's the conscious aspect of the thought that the I notion is labeling. But it doesn't stop there. It then says, I am this thing which I'm experiencing. That's what we call the ahankara. So what Ramana is saying, all right, what I want you to do now is, instead of letting the ahankara, the I notion, land on these things that are the changing experiences in the mind, go inside. Let go inside to the place from which the ahankara rises, or to the conscious being, you know, which is really the very... The inside of the I notion, the being, the self of the I notion, rather than stop it before it goes out here to land, to unite the self with something that's being, that's a changing experience. And he says, and if you do that, then what happens is that this, what he calls the ahanta, this I-ness, this sense of I that's normally landing on all of these things out here, what happens to it? He says, It falls away, and then he says, Pati Bhugna Shirsha, its head having bowed down. Pati Bhugna means to do like a, to bow down. Shirsha means its head. So it bows down humbly, right? It falls away having bowed down humbly. It can no longer function, in fact. So what he's saying from, you know, for Ramana, he is speaking out of his, always in his teaching, speaking out of his meditative experience. Because, do anybody know the story of Ramana? Ramana is considered a very great Mahatma sage from India. And there are a few texts that he's written, except Siddharshan is one of them, and Upadesha Sadam is another. Those are two that we often teach. But Ramana, before he was even taught Vedanta, taught the Upanishads, he was an unusual young man who spent, you know, days upon months just sitting in samadhi, and then he felt the samadhi. And he never even would come out of it, you know. Finally, at some point, he was actually taught an Upanishad, and when he was taught the Upanishad, it was just, the Upanishad was just saying what he already completely knew. Almost. What he almost completely knew. Because it was so just painting a picture of who he was, because his mind was continually resolved. The only thing he didn't know, which when he did know, he didn't need to meditate anymore, was that in fact there was no reason for his mind to resolve the universe. In other words, like if I shut my eyes, now I'm not seeing the universe, right? If you shut your eyes, the names and forms are gone. If you withdraw your ears, you know, sound is gone, etc. So you can, if you do japa and make your mind very quiet and turn it inward, the perceptual universe is not here. The emotional universe is not here. You know, the imaginal universe is not here. Why? Because you've withdrawn your sense perception and you've made your mind very quiet and you've turned your mind inward and made the mind fall into, in a sense, its own swarupa, its own nature. And he would just sit there in that. When he's sitting there in that, there is no activity, there is no I notion. The I notion, and what he means by that is, if my mind is thinking, then that's an activity of the mind, right? Like say if I'm looking at that painting, or I'm looking at the rug, or I'm having a memory, or I'm letting my mind imagine, or I'm thinking about something, those are all vrittis, thoughts, they all belong to the mind. The I thought also belongs to the mind. It's just a thought, you know? It's just a label. You don't have to walk around saying I. It's a vritti. Vritti means thought modification. So when that thought rises, if I just say casually, we use the I of, oh, I was thinking about this, and yesterday I went to the store, and then, you know, I met with someone, I. It's always rising its head. It's continually rising its head in relationship to all my experiences. But what about when you quieten your mind? Whether you're sitting in contemplation, you quieten your mind, and now the mind just is focused and absorbs into the very source, the very conscious being, which illumines all of these thoughts, is the self of all of these thoughts, including the self of the very I thought. That I thought, when the mind is active, it's just landing on every single, it's labeling yourself in every situation. It's relating, it relates you to every situation as I am that, I am that, I am doing this, I am seeing that, I am doing like that. It's only a thought though. It's a special type of thought that we call the I thought, but it is only a thought. Mm. And so now say, when the mind, buddhi, turns toward the very conscious being that is actually itself, that illumines it, what happens to that I thought? He says, patate. It falls away, head bowed. Means it resolved, what he means there, that its very head goes in, it totally resolves itself into its truth, the truth of its being, which doesn't speak. The self doesn't speak, right? The mind chatters away in its own subtle level. The vocal cords speak, the mouth speaks, the body does things, the mind thinks things, the sense organs sees things, you know. But what does the self do? What does the conscious being do? Is it seeing? If it is seeing, then why isn't it seeing when you lose your eyes? If it's hearing, then why doesn't it hear when you don't have ears? If it's thinking, why doesn't it think when the mind is asleep? See what I mean? What does consciousness itself do? And consciousness doesn't do anything, but it is the very stable, silent self that is there blessing everything that goes on. But all of this activity, including the activity of the mind, and the I, which is included as a vritti, go into the self, then that self, you know, vanishes. And he says, at that, it vanishes into its own source. It disappears. It falls away into its own source. And then he says, atta, and in doing that, he says, as it does that, aham anyat prakrishtam spurati. He says, another aham, which is prakrishtam uttamam, which is uttamam means, which is, prakrishtam means, which is much more exalted. Another aham, which is prakrishtam uttamam, the innermost in that which cannot be bettered, uttamam prakrishtam spurati. He says that as that happens, another self, anyat aham, another I reveals itself, which is an other I, which is uttamam, which is most exalted, reveals itself. So what does he mean by another I? Is there another I inside waiting to be discovered? It's not that. He says, well, let me finish this sentence, then I'll explain it. He says, na ahankritihi. And he says, and that I that reveals itself is not the ahankara, is not the I notion. Rather, it is paramam parameva purnam. Its being is infinite and param. When we say purnam, purnam means that which is infinite, absolutely full. The example for purnam comes from the root pra, which means to fill. Purnam is that which is full. It's a past tense. This thing, you can fill it as a verb, like you fill the glass of water. But a glass of water that is completely full can't be filled anymore. It's full. One more drop and it'll fall over. So purnam is that which is absolutely full, that which is absolutely complete. And it is padam. Padam means that which, what they say is desha kalavas to aparicheda. It means that which is limitless. It can't be limited by time or by space or by objectivity. And so when the ahankara resolves, remember what he's saying here is that when you have an ahankara, that is a thought in your mind. And that thought is labeling you the conscious being, but it is always adding something onto it. Like it'll say, I the conscious being and my mind. I the conscious being and the transmigrating jiva. I am this body. I am a woman. I am a man. I am short. I am tall. I am fat. I am happy. I am sad. I see well. I have 20/20 vision or my eyes are dimming. It's always, you know, I am related to so-and-so. The I that you use is always encapsulated. It's encapsulated by time, by space, and by quality. Quality would be man, woman, happy, sad, etc. Short, tall. Space would be I'm here and I'm not there. Time would be I'm living in this particular century, in this particular year, at this particular time. I wasn't living before 1948 and I probably won't be living 30 years from now. So I'm encapsulated. The I is encapsulated. It's encapsulated by my experiences. Not really. Not really. But the ahankara, when we say the I notion means it's born of ignorance. I notion, it's the notional I. The notional I is 50% correct. Right? Because half of what it has to say is true. I exist, I'm a conscious being. You know, actually the ahankara, the I notion, actually labels me. But the problem is that it's the mind that is labeling the self, its own self, which in reality is absolutely free and limitless. It's labeling the very being, that which gives it being. The mind is labeling that which gives it being and gives it consciousness. And then it says, so the mind itself is what talks. So the mind says, I am. Okay? And so it's labeling its truth, the conscious being, I am. These are words, I am. But the mind is limited. So the mind, the limited mind is saying, I am. So I, the limited mind, am. Mm. So now the amness, me, becomes the limited mind from the standpoint of the one who's saying it, which is the limited mind. See what I mean? Atma, yourself, isn't saying anything. Yourself simply is. It simply is what it is. There's not, it's the mind that's doing the running commentary. Now, what if that mind has self-ignorance? It's not total ignorance. The mind doesn't have total ignorance of the self. It has partial ignorance of the self. Because the mind doesn't have ignorance of the self-experience of consciousness and being. There's no ignorance there. It says, when the mind says, I am, I exist, it's labeling its own experience of existence and being. That's true. There's not ignorance there. When it says, I am conscious, I'm a conscious being, there's no ignorance there. You say, I exist, I'm a conscious being, your words are actually pointing to the fact of it. I exist, I'm a conscious being. That's true. So that's the partial knowledge. That's the general knowledge, and every one of us has said, I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. But the particular knowledge of the nature of it, my consciousness, is not there. Because it says, I, the limited mind, am the conscious being, and their consciousness is limited. And I, this limited mind, exist in this body, and this body is finite and subject to birth and death, and is located in this time, in this particular century, in this particular room. And this body is female, and that body is male. You know? And so, what happens is my self-experience is true, but it is shrouded in ignorance, and that's what we mean by the ahankara. The one who is labeling is ignorant of what they were, is partially ignorant of what they're labeling. That's why we use the rope, stake, snake example. If you're walking along the desk and you see something, you have to see something. To mistake it to see a snake there. You know, something has to make you see that snake. And what is it? In this case, it's a rope that has, you know, the three bends and an inch and a half in diameter. And there's a three bends and it's lying there on the side of the pathway along in the grass. And you're walking along and your eye sees the shape and mistakes that shape as a rope. As a snake. But you experience the shape, and then projected upon that shape is the snake. Here, my mind experiences me, the conscious being, as its very self, but doesn't recognize me as me, but rather superimposes itself upon me, and me upon itself. So the mind becomes a limited being. You know, the self becomes a limited being because it's given the mind, not because it does really, but because the mind gives it those qualities. And so here what he says is when because of this gaveshana, this seeking, the mind goes, the ahankara resolves into the self, then what happens is instead of there being a conditioned self, by these changing thoughts in the mind, there is just me, who am param. Param means limitless and absolutely full, totally unconditioned by anything, any of these experiences that I had loaded onto it. Mm. Right? And so he says, and in that, my own being, there is no ahankara. The ahankara resolves into its own self. Remember, the ahankara, the I notion, is called the hridaya grantihi, the knot of the heart. Knot of the heart means it is tied, like lassoing, this thought is lassoing my own being to all of these changing experiences in the mind. And then, that's what it believes, that's what it takes me to be. Now, in the rope snake example, when we have this little guy passing by and he mistakes the rope for a snake, his emotional life, the emotional life that he has is toward the snake, not the rope. And so the emotional life that we have, our reality, you know, is toward what we believe to be true. you know? So if I believe that's a snake, that's what I'm reacting to. It doesn't matter at all that really there's only a rope there. My reality is the snake. And here, in this world, my reality, until I know better, is this body, mind, sense organs that is here in this particular situation, you know, subject to change and subject to gain and loss, subject to happiness and sadness, you know, and definitely mortal. In fact, everything on every level of my experience is mortal. What that means is that on every level, I cannot have a lasting experience. It's impossible because there's nothing in the creation that is lasting. And so you can say, well, that's good for the dukkha, for the sorrow. At least the dukkha won't last. Of course, we never think like that, unfortunately. What we think is that the sukha, the pleasure will go away and the dukkha is going to remain. That's it, because it's frightening, you know. But if we look at it, our whole life is one of birth and death, birth and death, birth and death. It means the whole life is one of change. In terms of the changing experiences, the vritti, the content of the vritti, which is in continual perpetual motion. Even the ahankara is never constant. But that perpetual motion is taking place in something which is constant and which is pervasive, and that needs to be differentiated. So when Ramana was young in all of those years, he just absorbed his mind and sat in that undifferentiated, pure, limitless fullness, which is the nature of your own being. And when doing that, what ahankara? There is no ahankara. There is no I notion. There is no world. There is no universe. Nothing. Yeah. But when he came out, when he gained knowledge, what he realized is that, in fact, that conscious being that he is in the time of meditation is the same self that is pervasive to this creation. That this creation is not just like the pot can't separate itself from the clay. You know, that all of these changing names and forms that are being experienced are taking place in the silence and wholeness of myself. So you recognize, what is the difference to myself if I have my eyes open or closed? You know, if you close your eyes and open your eyes and close your eyes and open, there's nothing that happens to you at all, you know. If I have this thought or that thought, I myself remains exactly the same, pervasive to whatever the experience is. So why do I have to close my eyes to be in samadhi? I am always samadhi. I am the very samadhi. I am that. So what difference does it make whether I'm taking a walk or sitting and talking with people or what I'm doing? Nothing is happening to me. And that became obvious to him, and then he didn't meditate anymore because he never felt he wasn't meditating. Yeah. The same text Shankara in Aparochanabhuti in a Prakarana Granta that he teaches in the end of it, he says, why are you sitting in meditation? Aren't you meditating when you're standing? Who's meditating? Meaning that the content of any vritti, whether it's a quiet vritti or a perceptual vritti or an emotional vritti, the self is there as its very content, as its very truth. When is that not the case? So upon what are you meditating? Is there something that's not here? Are you not right here, right now, to be meditating on it? So the very self of the meditation is the very source of the meditation that you're meditating on. It's the very content. So there's like that clay pot. So when that ahankara falls away, he says, this other aham, which is its very source, it's not another aham coming forward, that very aham. That which is prakrishtam, that is what shines. And what is the nature of that self? That self has no ahankara. Right? That self has no ahankara, it's the self of the ahankara. It doesn't have an ahankara. And it is Paramevapurnam. It is absolutely whole and complete and full. and it is param limitless. Okay. So he says, tat parameva purnam. That is param eva purnam. That is param purnam. So now he says, to the next verse, Aham kritinyo lasati grisitva. Kintasya karyam parishishtamasti. Kinchit vijanati sanatmanonyata. Tasya stitim bhavayitum kshamakkaha. Now in this verse he's talking about the one who has realized this, the Jivan Mukta. And the commentator introduces it. He says, Jivan Muktasya Charya Duravagama. He says the activity, the behavior, the charcha, of a Jivan Mukta, of a liberated person who has self-knowledge, is difficult to understand, he says. The behavior and activity of somebody who has liberated that person, it's kind of difficult to understand. That's how he introduces it. So what he says here in the verse, the ahankriti is ahankara, this I notion. Yaha lasati grasitva. Yaha lasati, the one who shines, he who is manifest, who shines. Grasitva, having eaten the ahankara. Ahankritim grasitva. Yaha lasati, the one who is up shining, having swallowed the ahankara. Because when the ahankara goes to its own source, it just disappears. There's nothing for it to relate to. It just goes into its own being. And so it says, the one who shines there, kind of is left standing, the one who shines there, having swallowed grasitva, the ahankara, kim tasya karyam parishishtamasti, says, what is there left for him to do? What is to be done now by him? Kim means what? Tasya, for him, karyam, is to be done. Parishishtam. What is left to be done? Asti means is. So what is left for him to do? Right? What is to be done now? Now that once the aham has resolved into the atma, what is left to be? See, karyam, it's a potential participle. It means what is to be done? What is to be done now? Now that ahankara is resolved in itself, what is left for this person to do? What's to be gained by now? What should he do now? Now that this has happened. What's left to be done now? Once this has happened. Mm. And so he says, why? Kinchit vijanati saha na atmanaha anyat. He said, because he doesn't know, saha na vijanati. He doesn't know kinship, anything, atmanaha anyat, anything other than the self. Anyat means other. Atmanaha anyat, other than the self, kinship. So for him, there isn't anything else. There is nothing other than the self. Vijanati means janja, from the root Vijna, to know. Well, if you say vijna, vijanati is the verbal form, third person singular. It means to know clearly. Vishesha jnanam means to know, to recognize, to know not as a theory, but to actually have that aparoksha jnanam, to that direct immediate knowledge, to actually see, to actually recognize yourself. Not as the Shastra telling you how it is, and then you say, oh, this is how the Shastra says. This is what the scriptures say, or the Upanishads say that the self is. Then you can give a little lecture on it. That's not vijna. Vijna means that you actually recognize the truth of yourself. So you know it. You know it clearly. You recognize clearly. So what he recognizes clearly, he sees very clearly that there isn't anything, na kinchit, there isn't anything other than the self. if there is nothing other than the self, what then is there to be done? What now is to be accomplished? Once you see that the content of everything, all of these names and forms that are coming and going, have for their very being the consciousness. All these, including the ahankara, right? If you look at it like this, the I thought itself rises and sets in consciousness, right? If the ahankara itself rises and sets in consciousness, right, then every perception that you have, every experience that you have, rises and sets, changes, modifies, in what? In conscious being. What rises and sets itself does not have conscious being of its own accord. Why? Well, because it comes and goes in consciousness. Consciousness remains. It comes and goes in being. Being never rises and sets. Consciousness doesn't rise and set. Experiences rise and set. And by rise and set, I mean come into being and go out of being. Something that comes into being and goes out of being doesn't have any being of its own. Something that comes into consciousness and goes out of consciousness doesn't have consciousness. Right? It comes into consciousness, goes out of consciousness. Consciousness doesn't come into consciousness and go out of consciousness. Knowership comes into consciousness and goes out of consciousness because knowership requires the mind and the sense organs. Right? We think of, if I say to you, consciousness doesn't come into consciousness and go out of consciousness. You say, well, sometimes I'm not conscious. No. Sometimes you're not, when you say conscious, but when you say sometimes I'm not conscious, you're talking about subject-object relationship conscious of something, right? But to be conscious of something, you need a mind and sense organs. Like think of, if you have a dream, and you're a character in the dream, and you're experiencing the dream through your sense organs, right? And through your mind and sense organs as the dream character. And so then you say, well, I'm conscious of this dream and aware of this dream as long as I have my mind and sense organs. And that's true. That's subject-object relationship. But the mind and sense organs themselves are illumined by consciousness. The mind and sense organs themselves are known, right? You have a subject-object relationship with them. The thing is, if you take away the mind, you take away the sense organs, the consciousness, which allows them to be a knower, right, is now not a knower. And if you take away the mind, which is illumined, so that the mind has the experience of being known, if you take away the mind, what is left is the experience of being known without a subject-object relationship. That you have to meditate on, but it's a really wonderful thing to understand. So let me just do it one more time for you.
Please.
The thought, the mind, to say the mind is there. Like even whether it's a dream character, it doesn't matter, or just here itself. The mind is here. Whatever the thought is known. It doesn't make any difference what the thought is. You can say have a thought of a painting or have a memory. It doesn't make any difference, have an emotion. That whatever the thought is, and thoughts go on changing, the modifying, those thoughts are known, right? And so then what the ahankara says is it says, I am the knower of the thought, because the thought is known. You know? So the thought, now, but the thing is that ahankara that says, I am the knower of the thought, that is also known. That is also a thought. If you say, okay, here's the thought of an apple. Okay, I have an apple thought. And then I have another thought, the ahankara comes along and says, oh, I know the apple, I'm the knower of the apple. Okay. Say it's an imaginary apple. I know this imaginary apple. What if I say, okay, have a thought of an apple? And then I say, are you having the thought of the apple now? Yes, I'm having the thought of the apple. Are you aware of the thought that you're having of the thought of the apple? Are you aware of that? Oh, yes, that's also a thought. Okay. If you say, I know the apple, what if you say, I see the apple? say it's a real apple, I see the apple. I have a thought of the apple, I have a thought, I see the apple. All of these thoughts, whatever they may be, are known, right? But those thoughts go on and changing, changing, changing. What is the nature of the substratum that all those changing thoughts are enjoying? It is consciousness. What is the experience of something being known is the experience of consciousness. So you take away all, whether it's the ahankara thought or whatever thought it is, all of those thoughts are known, and I'm saying get rid of all of the thoughts, and what is left is the self-evident consciousness that we label as known in reference to whatever the objects are. That's what we mean by self-evident me. But is the consciousness a knower? If I'm a knower, what am I using to know? What is consciousness itself using to know something or to not know? Like, look, if I look at this wall or I look at this painting, I know this painting now. Why? Because my eyes are focused on it. The eyes, I need my eyes to know the painting. And then I need my mind to be focused on my eyes, which are focused on the painting, rather than daydreaming. Then what happens? I have a thought modification is created by that act of the eyes forming a thought modification. And now this thought modification is known. Right? It's an object of my awareness. And now I turn this way, and now that thought has gone away, and now this thought modification is known because my eyes are focused on it using my mind. I have a thought modification of this. No longer this. Now this is known. Now what if I shut my eyes? Now that not seeing anything that is brought about by the shutting of my eyes, now that is known. Now what if I daydream? And I can go on and on and on. There's something that never changes. And that is the very luminosity of consciousness itself. It doesn't require this or this or this thought. It doesn't require any thought. And it always is known. Consciousness always is known. That's what we mean. Not known by something, it is known because it is consciousness. That's why we say you are self-evident. So in any thought that you have, there's you, your presence, your self-evident knownness, and then whatever is in the thought modification enjoys that knownness. That's why sometimes, I've been doing this for years, and I always make this excuse that nobody likes this except me, but I do keep doing it, this particular thing, because I want somebody to get it. Sometimes I want it to be cut, give it a try in this way. If you look at, like, I'm going to use the painting and you can use the wall here. If I say that painting is known, or whatever it is I've seen in the wall, and then the intervening space between the painting and my body and everything in between, that is known. Okay? This body is known. Okay? My sense organs are known. You can focus on them, they're known. My mind is known. And whatever moods or imaginations, whatever is going on in the mind is known. Right? The I thoughts are known. And I am known. Me, the conscious being. Where is there an experience that isn't known? Even I, the conscious being, I am known. There is nothing that's not known. In any moment of experience, from the core of the self-evident me to the totality of whatever is in the experience, all of it is known. Now, where is the knower, really? Where is the knower? The knower is a construct that comes from identification with the mind and the sense organs. But actually in your experience, everything from the depth of your being me, the conscious being, to the farthest reaches of my sense perception or my mental imagination or the depth of my feeling, all of it is known. Because the truth of the whole experience is self-evident consciousness, is self-evident me. And I am known. And because of me, the conscious being, everything else is illumined. And so the conscious being is consciousness, and everything is illumined within consciousness. There need not be any knower, and there is no knower. There is only self-evident consciousness. The knowership, seer seen, feeler felt, all of these things exist within Maya. You know, like if you think of you have a dream, and the whole dream universe, you know, including the body, mind, sense organs, moods, emotions, everything. Everything exists within that dream in terms of subject-object relationship, knower, known, all of this. But in fact, the entire dream is known because of me. I am the self, the conscious being, who is the knownness, the consciousness, because of which everything in the dream is known. And every jiva within the dream, then because of self-ignorance, every jiva, every individual within that dream is saying, I am the knower, I'm the knower, I'm a knower, and I'm different from you. And that's the ahankara. The ahankara is a thought that identifies me, the conscious being from which the whole dream has come, with itself. The ahankara, the mind, which is abiding in this body through the sukshma sharira, saying, I am, I exist, I am this physical body, I live in this particular place, and I have these particular skills and these weaknesses and whatnot. You know, and I have this much money and I have this much health. On and on and on. You know? But the self, that the ahankara, that is the truth of the ahankara, its very, very self, is limitless as me. Now, it's not that the me, when I say this me is limitless, it's not that me becomes spatially limitless. Oh, I discover myself and I become spatially limitless. It's not, there is no space or time from the standpoint of yourself. Just think, if you have a dream, the time and space and dimension belong to the Maya of the dream. The time and space and dimension of this creation belong to the creation, right? Not to me. I'm not big or small, and I'm not red or white or blue or black. These are all gunas. They're all qualities that belong to the creation. But the reason I am limitless is because even though I'm not big or small, because space doesn't belong to me, that belongs to that Maya, there is nothing that's apart from me. Like right now, here you are in this room. There's no part of this room, this dimensional room, that's away from me, consciousness. Like this body, this painting is 10 feet from the body, but it's not 10 feet from consciousness. Right? You could say this painting is, the space, so it exists, the intervening space exists, the body exists, the mind exists, the perceptions exist. There is nothing away from being. You can't. If there's something away from being, it wouldn't exist. So the being and the being which exists is me. There's no other being. All of these things come in and out of being. I am the being. Right? And so the being that I am has to be differentiated from all these experiences that come and go. And so he says, so what for somebody, for the one who's eaten the, who swallowed this ahankara, you know, who the one who's left shining having swallowed the ahankara, the I notion, what's left for that person now to do? What's there to accomplish? What's left to accomplish? Then they say, okay, now I fulfilled this desire and now I need to fulfill this one. What desire is left to be fulfilled? He says, because that person doesn't see anything else but the self. It's like if you had a big bas relief block of clay, and there was a very ornate scene carved into the clay. There's still only clay there. There's nothing there but clay. So for the one who sees the clay, then what is that one going to accomplish? Clay is clay. So then what's to be achieved now? And so he says, in the introduction he says, this behavior of the Jivan Mukta could be a little difficult to understand. He's already answering, saying, kaha kshamaha, who is capable of bhavayitum, of bhavayitum means to contemplate or to understand or to even imagine the sthiti of that person. Sthiti means that the state of that person. Who can even imagine it? Because it's the difference. Who can't imagine it, really? You can't imagine it. You have to know it. Because it's going from being identified as a finite being within this creation to recognizing your being as the self of the creation. The change of self of the creation. And so the shift is so radical, it's so radical that until you yourself have made that shift, how could you even come upon that type of a thought? Because your mind and sense organs, the ones that are giving you knowledge, are only capable of giving you knowledge of what exists within the limited creation. And even your whole imaginal world, the whole imaginal world is based upon the what the sense data is able to give us. And so there's a shift that has to take place between my identification with the ahankara's identification with things within the universe to being swallowed or resolved into, humbly, as he said, humbly resolved into the self of the universe. When resolved into the self of the universe, then there's nothing here but me. But until that happens, the Atma, the self, is, because of the ahankara, remember it's the mind talking, not the self, because of the self-ignorance of the mind, the ahankara is taking myself and lassoing it, superimposing it onto my body, mind, sense organs, and vice versa, and then I become a conscious being within this world, subject to birth and death and mortality, etc. So, that's these two verses. Take a moment. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.